give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is BMG Music against Gonzalez. Mr. Baker.
May it please the court. Good morning, Judge Easterbrook, Judge Evans, Judge Williams.
Morning.
This case is before you today after the district court summarily decided that Cecilia Gonzalez was not entitled to a jury trial on damage issues, liability issues, or any other issues in her copyright infringement case. Unfortunately, 7 years ago, now Chief Justice John Roberts vehemently and appropriately argued that in all copyright infringement cases, including those involving damages, as is the case here, the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution guarantees.
Well, if there is a disputed issue of material fact, right, summary judgment is consistent with the Seventh Amendment. Now, the question is, what is the disputed issue of material fact?
Well, among them is damages, Your Honor, as the Supreme Court noted in its clear and concise language.
What is the issue of material fact?
Damages, if any.
No, damages is a result. What is the issue of material fact?
With due respect, Your Honor, I think that the unanimous Supreme Court...
No, look. What is the issue of material fact? You just be concrete and tell me what it is.
The amount of damages, if any.
That's not an issue of fact.
In
that
addition,
is a conclusion that is reached.
In addition, Your Honor, Ms. Gonzalez was denied the ability to present her fair use defense.
What is the issue of material fact? Can you tell me?
There are at least two under the fair use defense, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Number one, whether or not Ms. Gonzalez's use was commercial or, as we see it, non-commercial. There is clear evidence that there was no effect on her...
Can you tell me what an issue of fact is? I guess I'll quit now. Whether something is commercial or non-commercial is a phrase attached. It's a conclusion that one draws based on facts. What are the disputed issues of fact that are pertinent to drawing such conclusions?
Among them, Your Honor, are whether or not she purchased or whether or not her downloading affected her purchasing. That is a clear issue of material fact.
Are you trying to say whether her conduct affected the market?
That is actually an additional issue of material fact. And there is absolutely no evidence in this record that Ms. Gonzalez's conduct affected any market. What there is clear and
why would that be necessary?
Because under the fair use analysis, it's among the four factors. In fact, the two disputed here.
I don't understand that. I must be missing something.
And perhaps none, I'm missing something.
No one's individual behavior affects the market. All right, that's the whole point. Markets are really big. People are really small.
As a cumulative effect, Your Honor.
Yeah, but that's not a disputed issue in any given case.
It is, because here the only evidence shows that the downloader, the accused infringer, continued to purchase the product that is at issue.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's suppose your client was a shoplifter, and she went into Barnes & Noble and shoplifted books. And her defense when she was accused of shoplifting was that she wanted to read the books at home, and the ones she liked, she would go back and pay for. Would there be any material dispute about whether that was fair use?
Well, you're now talking about a criminal statute, so I think the answer is absolutely not. But here we're talking about a civil liability. And the issue
is easier to establish than criminal liability. So,
Your Honor is correct. The burden of proof is much easier. However, here what we're also talking about is
why is this any different from the shoplifting example? Surely it wouldn't be part of anybody's burden to show that the few stolen books generally affected the market in the output of any of these books.
I disagree, Your Honor, with a great deal of respect, because I think your analogy and your hypothetical is an important one. However, here, Ms. Gonzalez, first of all, was not a shoplifter. She may have gone into a library and looked at a book and then decided if she was going to purchase it, and indeed purchased over 98% of those books, in your analogy, that she did look at. The evidence in this record shows...
There's a big difference between going into a bookstore, looking at pages of the book in the bookstore, and deciding what to buy. That's equivalent to listening to these songs over the radio. And stealing the book, and then later deciding that you'll purchase some of them and keep the rest without paying.
Let's follow Your Honor's radio analogy. Ms. Gonzalez could have recorded the song on the radio and been clearly under the radar, for starters. Additionally, we still believe there's a home copying exemption based on the Sony case. All we're looking at here is a quantum leap forward in technology that copyright holders, Luddites, as we aptly call them in the brief, they're unwilling to accept. I have to get back, I believe, Your Honor, to the evidence of record, because that's how cases must be decided. And in this case, there is no evidence of record that there has been any material harm whatsoever to the copyright holders. There is substantial evidence of record that Ms. Gonzalez purchased an inordinately large number of CDs, particularly compared to those that she listened to. And I'm actually talking about singles, not compact discs, which are compilations.
Well, isn't there also another factor? Because there are four factors that basically we should look at. There's no question that it's copyrighted, no question that she copied the whole thing. So one of the questions is, what was the use of the material? You know, was it commercial by nature, that kind of thing? That's one factor that you've argued. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And what's the issue with respect to that?
Well, with respect to that, as we see it under Napster, the decision ought to come down to whether or not her use affected her purchasing, whether or not she was taking it, under Judge Easterbrook's analogy, taking it without any intent to pay for it. Our view is that that's absolutely not the case, and that there's substantial evidence in the record that at least supports a jury looking at this. I have to get back to the damages issue, because we're 7 years on after Feltner. There is unequivocal language, a unanimous Supreme Court, except
if there's a material dispute. We come back to my question. There's a statute which prescribes a minimum amount. Now, the jury will not be allowed to disregard the statute, and no amount in excess of the statutory minimum has been awarded. So what material disputed issue of fact is there for the jury?
The reasoning of the Supreme Court, and having just reread several times the oral argument by now Chief Justice Roberts,
it's completely irrelevant
he
who
looked
argued
at
cases in the Supreme Court.
He looked at three statutes
look,
at the time.
Look, can I guess I'll just give up.
New Hampshire, Your Honor,
I
Connecticut.
I don't care about New Hampshire. I care about the legal rule, which is that juries get to resolve disputed issues of material fact. Summary judgment is perfectly consistent with the Seventh Amendment. That's why I'm looking for what material disputed issue of fact is relevant to the amount of damages.
I apologize for perhaps testing my temerity or your tolerance, Your Honor. The Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit later confirmed this, said that 504C, to the extent that it takes the damages issue away from the jury, is unconstitutional.
What damages issue? There's a statute which prescribes a minimum amount and then the possibility of greater damages. If the plaintiff were asking for greater than the statutory minimum, obviously that would be a jury question. I don't understand how any jury would be allowed to award less than the statutory minimum, so what material dispute is there?
With due respect, that's precisely our argument, because that was the case
at
the time of the
You think that
the
Seventh Amendment allows juries to disregard federal statutes?
I think if that federal statute is unconstitutional, you're absolutely right, Your Honor. And that was precisely the case when now Chief Justice Roberts argued. The three state copyright issues had the exact type of range that exist today under our federal copyright statute. However, the Supreme Court, knowing that, still determined that 504C was unconstitutional. I believe Your Honor's argument is valid and reasonable. However, I believe also, and I think the case is clear, Feltner at the Supreme Court level and when it went back to the Ninth Circuit unconstitutionalized 504C to the extent that it took that issue away from the jury.
Can you speak to that point where the jury can, under some circumstances, or the amount can be a sum of not less than $200?
Certainly. Do you mean the innocent infringement?
Right.
Well, that's yet another issue that we believe we ought to be able to present some evidence. What precisely was Ms. Gonzalez trying to do? She was trying to increase her knowledge and appreciation of music while putting money into the pockets of the appellees. She was not trying to... She's not a radical out at Berkeley or a pimply-faced kid in Princeton, New Jersey, who's sharing millions of files. Indeed, the only evidence of record, which is Exhibit B, to their complaint, shows that she was not sharing. The biggest problem here is that the record companies decided to pick on somebody who was actually one of their good customers.
No, look, maybe I just have to give up. There has to be some material dispute. What is the material dispute with respect to the question whether the innocent infringer defense applies? Statute seems to say, this is 402D, that if the copyright notice is printed on the CD, there is no innocent infringer defense whether or not the particular infringer knew about that notice. Now, is that a correct statement of what's in the statute?
It's awfully close, Your Honor. It actually says no weight shall be given, which
right.
we believe also
so
shows
what's the,
that there's a
what's
jury
the material
issue.
Dispute about the difference between the $750 and the $200?
Well, the amount, for starters, that's $550 per. That's a substantial amount of money to a woman who has five children and emigrated to this country.
I'm trying to figure out what the dispute is, right? The material dispute of fact, the rule for summary judgment.
Whether or not she innocently infringed looks
no,
to facts such as...
I'm done.
I'll respectfully reserve the remainder of my rebuttal time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you.
Mr. Webb.
Good morning. May it please the court. There are essentially two issues that this court needs to address that will resolve every remaining issue in this appeal. First, is the defendant's subjective intent relevant to the issues of liability? The answer to that question is absolutely not as a matter of law. The statute and the case law make it clear that copyright infringement is a strict liability tort. Intent has nothing to do with it. Defendant's attempt to graft intent into the statute is not well taken and completely unsupportable. Without the proof of intent, defendant's sampling argument disappears. Her fair use case also disappears because her use will then become, as a matter of law, commercial. And as the Supreme Court held in Sony, commercial use presumes that it will be market harm. Without intent, there is no fair use, there is liability. The second issue is the innocent infringement defense available to the defendant? As a matter of law, the answer to that is no. Under Section 402D, a notice was placed on all distributed copies, and the defendant had access to those copies. Because of this, innocent infringement defense, which goes to liability or damages only, is not available to the defendant. For that reason, the statutory minimum of $750 per infringed work applies. There are no disputed issues of material fact as to that result. For those reasons, in view of this record, the judgment of the lower court must be affirmed. I'd like to now clear out some of the underbrush to make this a little bit easier for the court. First of all, infringement is undisputed and indisputable. Every court addressing these facts has found there to be infringement and no fair use, including this court. In U.S. v. Slater, this very court...
I don't see why what this court has said matters very much. I mean, neither side has made very much of the Supreme Court's Grokster case. I should think that Grokster is what we need to look at to figure out whether there was primary infringement. Now, I suppose the finding of secondary infringement is pretty much conclusive on the issue of primary infringement.
That's a good point, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in Grokster found that this conduct represented infringement on a gigantic scale. This court in U.S. v. Slater called a claim of fair use for Internet piracy to be preposterous. That's not my word. That's the word of this court, preposterous to claim that Internet piracy is fair use. We also moved on 30 works. No question about it, we moved for summary judgment on 30 sound recordings. We did that for the sake of simplicity, not because
Behavior in Slater was rather different from the behavior here.
It was. There were conspiracy issues there, but the court analyzed fair use, which would have been...
The scale of it was rather different as well.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the defendant downloaded 1,374 music files. Now, Mr. Baker informed the court that she owned 98% of those. However, she admitted under oath that she owned only 200 CDs. If you assume, for the benefit of her doubt, that each of these CDs was by a different artist, so there are 200 available artists. Exhibit B to the complaint, which lists 1,374 music files that she downloaded, comprises well over 350 artists. Clearly, Mr. Baker's claim is not supported by the facts. Moreover,
so then, according to your math, then that wasn't 98% of the songs?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, based upon our analysis of the actual titles...
Well, it sounds like we need a jury trial. You're now disputing her version of the facts, and as soon as you do that, we've got a material dispute, and we need a jury trial. You're busily shooting your foot full of holes. You got any more...
Your Honor, we are not moving on any of those files that she claims that she owned. We're moving on 30 sound recordings, which she admitted in a stipulation that she didn't own. Those are the only sound recordings
so
at
issue.
So that's
30 out of 1,374. Right. So,
and that's what we have to assume. Otherwise, there's a material dispute.
You can. For the sake of this argument, you can assume that she owned every single one of those because it doesn't matter. As your analogy pointed out, just because you buy occasionally from a record store does not absolve you from liability for stealing many more. There's no buying defense to stealing. And
but
that's exactly what happened.
If this is a strict liability situation, why would there ever be a fair use affirmative defense that's where we have to look at each of those cases in a fact-specific way? In other words, we have to look at the facts and circumstances. Why would we ever have to look at the facts and circumstances? If you show that there's infringement and you show the other element, which is not contested, that it was copied totally, then why even have these other tests? Why have the effect of the use on the potential market? Why have the purpose and character of the use? Why
because
have an affirmative defense?
Because there are situations where copying can be excused from liability. For example, for news commentary, for criticism, for educational purposes. Some uses that would otherwise be infringing can be immune from liability under the Fair Use Act.
So your position is it can't be for research, as she said, to review like those 30-some songs that we were talking about. That could never be I don't want to say it could never be, but
sure.
that could not be a legitimate basis or at least an arguable way that she would use the material.
Well, intent is not relevant. You look at the facts surrounding the use to determine purpose and character. For example, if she were to take these works and go to a class and teach things about musical composition, that might be different. Here the facts are these. She downloaded full and complete copies of 30 sound recordings without authorization. She stored them permanently on her hard drive of her computer. 1 year later, when we deposed her, they're still there. And finally, when she downloaded, she just didn't download personally to her hard drive. She put in a shared folder for millions of other people to copy. She simultaneously downloaded and placed into distribution for others. And one other thing I'd like to clear out before we move in to the other issues. If she were not sharing files, if she didn't put these musical files into a shared folder, we never would have found her. That's how we caught her, is that we were getting on that site, a public site, and found that she had 1,374 songs available for the world to copy without any limitation. Clearly she was sharing or we would not be here today. As this court has found, fair use is unavailable for Internet piracy. As a matter of fact, this court, when viewing the issue of commercial use, found that to argue otherwise would violate the straight-face test. Here, clearly her use was commercial. She took something that she would otherwise have to pay for. Also, by downloading, she automatically made those same works available for others to copy. That is not consistent with a claim of fair use and copying.
So your bottom line is, if she had just kept them on her hard drive, not put them in a music sharing file, your case would disappear, or
no.
A lot of the guts of your case would be gone.
No, Your Honor, that's not it at all. That certainly is a fact that makes her conduct more egregious. But by downloading the music onto her hard drive, that fact alone was infringement. And that fact alone was commercial use, because this is stuff that she would have to otherwise purchase. There are legitimate websites out there that you can go to and download files from. She didn't do that. By doing that, she deprived the record companies of the revenue that they were entitled to get for these works. The effect of the market. Once the use is commercial, market harm is presumed. The record has two studies offered by the plaintiffs showing losses of jobs, declining revenue, and other tangible impact on the market. But it's not our burden. Keep in mind this. Fair use is an affirmative defense. It's the plaintiff's burden to show that there is evidence to support their defense. It's not our burden to disprove it. That being said, we offered studies, undisputed, unrebutted, and without any objection from the defendant, and those studies form the basis of the record upon which a finding of harm to the market can be found under the district court level. Moreover, this court found in Slater that it's fairly obvious. When you take that which does not belong to you without paying for it, when you download copyrighted works from the Internet, there's clearly going to be market harm. And if others were to do this, let's say others could go to websites and download music with impunity, without any fear of being found liable in a civil court, what would that do to the music industry? If you could get something for free, why in the world would you ever pay for it? That's the conduct at issue here today. Downloading music that she didn't own, that was not authorized by the copyright owners, and she stored it permanently on her hard drive. That is not fair use. Her sampling argument, even if sampling were relevant, even if intent were somehow relevant to infringement, which it is not, her sampling argument does not comport with the facts. Sampling is not downloading full and complete copies and keeping them on your hard drive permanently, at least for a year. That is not sampling. She did not take a part and then delete shortly thereafter. I'd like to address a couple of issues. Home copying.
Why was the damages request limited to the 30 tracks rather than the more than 1,000 that were made available worldwide to strangers?
Your Honor, for sake of simplicity.
I mean, one would think that damages would be available for that, even if they were all put into Kazaa by somebody who bought them originally on CD.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't think I understand your question.
I go out. I buy a CD. I join up to the Kazaa service. I rip the tracks from the CD that I own, and I then make them available for everyone else in the world to download. I violated the copyright laws.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But none of your theory of damages responds to that fact, right?
Well, the evidence is, the stipulation that's a part of the record, the defendant stipulated she never owned any of these works. Stipulated that we did, in fact, my client owned them. And that she copied them without authorization.
You're not addressing my...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm dealing with what happens for works that are owned, that is, purchased, by the person who is then sharing them.
Okay.
I mean, what is the liability for somebody who makes the files available, makes his own files available to strangers?
I understand, Your Honor. That is a violation of one of the exclusive rights of the copyright owner for distribution.
That's why I'm asking why you didn't ask for damages on that theory, because that's, in many ways, a much easier theory than the 30 tracks.
It might be, Your Honor, but in this instance, we know for a fact that she admitted to downloading 30. We used our discretion. We picked only those theories that we thought made sense. We picked only the number of works that really made sense, whether 300 or 1,300. 30 is a lot for this lady, and we understand her limited means.
$22,000 or $22 million
is
immaterial.
Equally
uncollectible. Unfortunately, Your Honor, you're right. You're right. I mean, at some point, it becomes diminishing return. How much is enough? We submit that 30 is more than enough.
Actually, the reason why I raise this is because there's no conceivable fair use defense with respect to making the files available through the Kazaa system. There is a conceivable fair use defense on this sampling theory. Whether it's right or wrong, we will have to decide. But there's no even arguable. There's just no room for argument about making them available through Kazaa.
We agree. And, Your Honor, with all due respect, we also agree there's no conceivable fair use defense with respect to downloading works to your permanent hard drive without authorization of the copyright owner, not protected by any home copying exception, certainly not protected under fair use.
Can you speak to this innocent infringer question and whether or not there's a material fact?
Yes, Your Honor.
Particularly since the statute talks about a right to a jury trial, including the amount itself.
Correct. The innocent infringement, we used the copyright notice. It was distributed widely. The defendant had access, so there's no innocent infringement defense. You can't depart below 750. With respect to Feltner, its argument about how a jury is entitled to review all issues, including damages. We don't dispute that a jury trial is mandated for statutory damages if there are disputed material facts. As Your Honor pointed out, there are none. The fact is, $750 is the bottom dollar. Not one penny less is appropriate under the statute. That's all we sought. Therefore, the Seventh Amendment is not implicated here. There are no disputed issues of fact. Therefore, there's nothing for a jury to decide. It's that simple. With respect to Feltner, there are many issues concerning damages in a statutory damages context. None of those exist here. It's undisputed that she infringed these works. They're all registered. They were all registered before she infringed them. 750 times the number of works. Simple math.
Well, you say all those things. Are all those things undisputed on this record?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They're stipulated, as a matter of fact, in the record. Okay. A stipulation that these copyright registrations are issued duly.
That makes them undisputed.
Okay. With that, I believe my time is up. Any more questions from the court? I'd be happy to answer them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Webb.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Baker?
Very limited, Your Honor.
I feel obligated, Your Honors, to address a few of the items that Mr. Webb just addressed. The only evidence of record emphatically states that Ms. Gonzalez was not sharing. It's frustrating to Ms. Gonzalez that the appellees continually bring up this viral distribution.
Is it possible to use the Kazaa system and have the server turned off?
It's possible to use the Kazaa system and not share. I think, however, as I understand it, the burden rests with the plaintiff to show that there was distribution and a violation of the distribution right. That doesn't rest with the defendant. And the only evidence that they put in the record clearly shows that she was not sharing.
Of course, let me just make sure I have this straight. When her computer's on and she's in that system, anyone can access what she's got on her files.
That is an
right?
excellent question, Judge Williams,
right?
And it is actually inaccurate because she can and did choose to say not sharing. I don't want you coming into my computer. And I also feel obligated to address this issue that she maintains them on her hard drive. Of course she does. If she didn't, they would be in here barking that she was spoliating evidence. They asked us to keep her hard drive intact. It's nonsensical to now argue against her that she now somehow keeps them. Of course she does. It's evidence in the civil case.
It's not a question of keeping them after she was caught. I thought the plaintiff's point was that this is inconsistent with her try before you buy theory, that these 30 tracks, at least, she may have tried, she decided not to buy, and she did not delete.
It brings up an excellent timing argument.
The best fair use argument would be, this is just like a radio, right? Instead of waiting for this song to appear on a stream over the internet where I could listen to it and it's streaming and it evaporates, I've downloaded, I listened to it, and then I deleted it.
Right.
But your client didn't do that. That's undisputed in this record.
Ms. Gonzalez only had access to the internet for, I believe, several weeks, if that, before she was served with the complaint. There's a minimal amount of time for her to have done anything. Since the time of the statute of Anne, juries have decided damages issues. The framers spilled their blood to ensure that the Seventh Amendment guaranteed everyone, including Cecilia Gonzalez, that right. And
Feltner, if the jury returned a verdict and said damages are $100 per song, would the judge be obligated to raise that to $750 on motions after verdict?
I don't believe so because of Feltner. in the Ninth Circuit ongoing or subsequent litigation in Feltner that stated that taking the jury, the damage issue away from the jury, renders 504C unconstitutional.
Okay.
And I would add only that Judge Scalia didn't even get to the constitutional issue, but found it to be a statutory issue.
Let me just ask you this. Since you were alleging the affirmative defense, did you put on evidence showing that she had some blocker or something on the file sharing? Did you speak to that question at all before the court? And what evidence did you put in?
She testified to that. That
just
was before
her testimony,
the court.
Just her testimony that she didn't want anybody to have access? And that she put some blocker on it so no one could have access?
That's accurate, and I actually have to address the fact that...
I don't see how you say that's accurate. My understanding, and obviously, Judge Williams, is that file sharing is part of the Kazaa system. It cannot be turned off.
Yeah.
Now, it's conceivable you could manipulate the firewall to your system in a way that prevented anybody from the outside from coming in. But there's just no switch in Kazaa that says file sharing off.
I think the evidence shows, quite frankly, that is exactly what it shows, that you absolutely can do that. And there's no question about that. And there's no evidence, Judge Williams, to respond directly to your question, there's no evidence from the plaintiffs. No evidence whatsoever. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. If the court has no further questions.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
No, there's no switch. No need to worry about it.
All right. Okay.
All right. The case is taken under advisement.